In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, we begin by praising Allah, the Lord of the world, the Lord of mankind and all that exists. As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah. We are very privileged to having Yvonne Ridley there as our guest speaker. Just an introduction, brief introduction of Yvonne Ridley. She's an award-winning journalist of more than 25 years standing and author of two books, In the Hands of the Taliban and Ticket to Paradise. She has spent the last 10 years working for several prestigious street newspapers, including the Sunday Times, The Observer, The Independent on Sunday and Sunday Express. Whilst working for the Daily Mirror, Sister Yvonne rose to the international fame in September 2001 when she was captured by the Taliban in Afghanistan, when she went undercover into the country wearing the all-enveloping burqa dress of an Afghan woman. She was detected and was held for 10 days before being released on humanitarian grounds on the orders of Mullah Omar. In the last 2 years, Yvonne has become an international peace campaigner and anti-war activist, sharing platform with high-profile personalities including the Rev. Jesse Jackson, British politicians George Galloway and Tony Benn, Palestinian activist Leila Khalid and Ahmed Ben Bella, former Algerian president and revolutionary leader. She is also a founder member of Women Journalism and an active member of the recently formed Respect Political Party in England. She is a leading member of the British anti-war movement and has given lectures throughout the Middle East, Australia, South Africa, Europe and the US on the First World War on Terror, women in Islam and media coverage of the war in Iraq, Afghanistan and Palestine. She has also expanded into television and radio producing several documentaries from Iraq and Afghanistan. So that first lay on now hundreds of people who will talk on the status of women in Islam, and she has also very kindly agreed to talk on her account on embracing Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers, sisters and friends, Salaam alaikum. The Muslim world has always been regarded as fanatically religious, barbaric and extremely dangerous thanks to centuries of demonization which can be traced right back to the very early days of the Crusades. In many ways, the horrific events of September 11 reinforced that view, but something really positive began to emerge from the rubble and the burning embers of the Twin Towers. Furious Westerners descended on bookshops throughout Europe and North America. They wanted to buy books on Islam, and the Quran became a bestseller. And then something else that was really strange began to happen. Westerners began reverting to this religion in huge numbers, and the larger proportion of these reverts were women. Western feminists were quite perplexed by this, because as far as they were concerned, these women who were embracing Islam were a traitor to their sex. How could they follow a religion which oppressed women and defeminized them? I too would have felt like this had I not begun to read the Quran and other Islamic literature, which was an undertaking that I had given during my captivity when I was held by the Taliban. I was asked if I would like to convert to Islam, and I told them that I couldn't make such a life-changing decision while I was in prison, but if they let me go, I promised I would read the Quran. In truth, I would have promised them anything just to get out. But they released me on the 8th of October, which was the day after America and Britain had launched the war, and hundreds of innocent Afghan men, women and children had been slaughtered by these bombs. And I thought, against all the odds, they kept their word and they released me. So really, when I got home, I thought I should keep mine. But furthermore, as a journalist covering the Middle East, it was quite shocking that I knew very, very little about this faith. And what I did know, or what I thought I knew, turned out to be a pile of rubbish anyway. For those of you who might think as well that, oh, she's clearly suffering from Stockholm Syndrome, I can tell you my 10 days in Afghanistan were absolute hell. for my captors. I spat at them, I swore at them, I cursed them. I was the prisoner from hell, and when I was released on humanitarian grounds, I'm not sure who was more happier to see me cross the border, them or me. In fact, I often wondered if it was the humanitarian efforts of the Taliban that's why I was released. So I can assure you, I certainly did not bond with my captors. But what I did do, because they kept their word, I kept mine, and I began reading the Quran. And I wanted to find out what is in this book that really does promote the subjugation of women. And some Muslims in Harrow who found out that I was reading the Quran presented me with a translation by A. Yusuf Ali, and it had an index in the back, so I immediately started cherry picking and going through all the women's issues. And I was absolutely taken aback by what I was reading, because the Quran makes it perfectly clear, crystal clear, that women are equal in spirituality, worth, and education. And it doesn't just end there. We're praised for our childbirth and child rearing capabilities. And then other Islamic literature I was reading, I discovered that the first revert to Islam was a woman, the first martyr to Islam was a woman. When the verses of the Quran were finally compiled into book form, the person who looked after the first ever copy of the Quran was a woman. During the Battle of Ehud, when the Prophet was being attacked, it was a woman who was on the battlefield fighting alongside the men, who was everywhere protecting him, and he singled her out for praise. And I'm thinking, you know, not only does this book say that we're equal, but it elevates the status of women. Who's speaker in paradise? The mother. Who's the most important person in the home? The mother, the mother, the mother. And I'm thinking, this is saying that we are the deluxe model of the human being. There's all a smile from this side of the room on that. I then began looking at inheritance laws, divorce and property rights. In fact, this is probably where these Hollywood lawyers get their inspiration from. And we get all these tabloid headlines about pop stars having prenuptial agreements. Prenuptial agreements have been available to Muslim women since day one, marriage contracts, where couples outline exactly what they want and expect. And furthermore, when a Muslim woman gets married, you don't have to take the name of the man that you're marrying, which, again, I just thought this is really quite liberating. And it occurred to me that the women's liberation did not begin in the 70s when Western women took to the streets and started burning their bras. And I could never understand this bra burning thing, because I've never seen so many happy men when women say, right, we're demanding equality, we're going to burn our bras, and the men would applaud them and encourage them. But it just occurred to me that the liberation movement actually began 1400 years ago in the pages of the Quran. Rights bestowed on Muslim women all those centuries ago have only recently, maybe in the last 100 years, come into the gift of Western women. In fact, just about everything that the feminist movement in the 70s strived for was already available to Muslim women. And yet still, women in the West looked upon conversions like mine as a complete catastrophe. And what I would say to those women is, you know, read the Quran first, or try and read some Islamic literature first, and see for yourselves why women find so much liberation in this great faith. But, you know, this is the, people get very, very excited about the hijab, and it's not just a one-dimensional marker of gender oppression, and nor is it, you know, just the cover for the heat or the rain, although I can tell you, in this cold weather, it's wonderful. But what this tells you, it's part of a business suit. This tells you, I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim woman and I want you to respect me. That's what this simple little garment tells you. Can you imagine stopping a business executive in thread legal suit and saying, what are you wearing a business suit for? Why don't you chill out, put on jeans and a t-shirt? You'd be far more comfortable. Could you imagine walking in to see your bank manager and if you had a pair of green and a pin in his cheek and holes in his jeans, you'd be thinking, you know, is this the right person that I should be seeing? It's you know, your clothes are a label. And as I say, the hijab tells you exactly who I am and what I expect from you and probably what you expect from me. But, you know, if the veil is a symbol of oppression, why do women in this country and across Europe and in America, why do women who choose to have white weddings wear the veil? You know what, if they really think the veil is a symbol of oppression, why would they wear a veil? And isn't it interesting when we look at the typical white wedding, where the woman is given away by one man to another man whose name she must take. It's really quite bizarre. And if the veil is a symbol of oppression, shouldn't we go and storm the Vatican and liberate all those nuns? You know, it's one of the greatest supporters of women's rights was the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. A man who washed his own clothes, donned his own socks, and there's evidence that he also cooked, especially fed his young wife, Aisha. Khadija, his first wife, was an international businesswoman who employed him and encouraged him to work. It was she who he turned to after he heard the word of God. And it was she who persuaded him of the significance of this message. So had it not been for Khadija, a mere woman, and Islam's first reader, who supported the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, when the first revelations were revealed, when many people rejected the message, who knows how things would have turned out. She herself was a shining example of a liberated woman. And his last wife, Aisha, was also a leading feminist of her time. Islamic scholars regarded Aisha as significant enough to consult over the interpretation of Islamic laws. And she spent the last 40 years of her life often advising such scholars. Islam is responsible for the banning of many misogynistic practices, including the infanticide of newborn baby girls, when there was a time when men only wanted male heirs. Yet when our ancestors were living in huts and wearing sackcloth, the Muslim world was devising reading, writing, scientific theories, you know, very sophisticated, gave inspiration and sparked the Renaissance period. It's quite amazing the way that the British Empire rewrote history and changed history. Fine silks and other luxurious materials were produced, and as I say, the Renaissance was inspired by the Muslim world. Islam is much misunderstood in the West, which could explain the Western media's portrayal of Muslim women as a bunch of silent, subjugated, helpless creatures. I have to say much of this has been reinforced by various male-dominated cultures across the region. There was a heroic schoolgirl from Luton who missed 2 years of formal education because she made a stand about wearing her Islamic dress to school. She went through court. Quite an ordeal for anyone, but for a 15-year-old girl, it was a huge ordeal. I really salute the courage of that 15-year-old girl to make a stand for her faith. That's what she was basically doing. But, you know, there are countries where women's education is being denied, and again, it has absolutely nothing to do with Islam. And don't these foolish men see that this behavior is twisted and manipulated by the West as a justification for dominating countries and bombing others? Now let's turn the spotlight on Western women for a moment, because they face a different kind of male-led tyranny, but tyranny all the same. And of course a great emphasis is put on your size and shape in this country, across Europe, across America and Canada. And we are constantly bombarded with images and glossy magazines and newspapers of models who are over 6 foot tall and just impossibly thin. And the message is quite simple. If you're not tall, slim and beautiful, then you will become unloved and unwanted. And this is illustrated in the amount of eating disorders there are across these countries. 1 in 10 women in their life will suffer from some sort of eating disorder. And in one of the national newspapers just a few days ago, they said that eating disorders were now emerging in five-year-olds. Five-year-olds, you know, when children should be having fun and playing and learning things, they're worrying about their size and shape. You know, half the kids are anorexic and the other half are obese. It's absolutely ridiculous. Plastic surgeons are inundated with unhappy women striving for an impossible image which requires more than a little nip and tuck. Educational achievements appear to be secondary to physical attributes. And of course these images are being reinforced by those men who are more impressed by the size of a woman's breast than her brain. The advertising industry is obsessed with the female form. Half-naked women are seen draped across cars. You know, what sort of message does that send out? I thought you bought a car for what was under the bonnet, not what was lying across the top. And for as long as there has been an advertising industry, women's bodies have been used to sell anything from a toothbrush to a tractor. I don't know if you can remember the airline that had great big billboards in London illustrating a large pair of breasts bursting out from the top of a bikini with the slogan, "Weapons of Mass Distraction." It was before I reverted to Islam, and I found this grossly offensive anyway, you know, and I just thought, what is this? You know, why do I have to look at this? A beer advert, this was a strange one, on television, shows a half-naked woman lying on top of her bed, pouring the drink over her body in the hope of attracting her man. Now, I'm sorry, you know, I come from Newcastle, and if a woman did that up in Newcastle, she probably ends up being battered and put in the casualty ward. It's absolute madness, these sort of fantasy adverts, but that is what has been thrown at us. And a supermodel recently posed naked on a sofa, and she was advertising perfume, you know, what else? It's really, you know, I do despair, but seriously, what professional career can a Western woman do that a Muslim woman can't? Not being judged by your appearance, the size of your bust, or the length of your skirt is a form of liberation, and that is the sort of liberation that I want for my daughter. As one sister told me during one of my travels, she said, "Look, my head might be covered, but my brain is not." And as my daughter grows up, I want her to be respected for who she is and not what she wears. But most importantly, I want her to respect herself and her body.
Thanks, Christine, wonderfully, for giving us the time and coming here to talk to us and the face of women. As promised, after each presentation, each talk, there will be a question and answer session. Question here, what is your view on female imams?
by imams, I'm taking that whoever wrote the question means scholars, and I've already mentioned before that Aisha was one of the greatest scholars of Islam, who happened to be a woman, and that she advised and guided many other scholars on their work over a 40-year period. Should a woman in Islam marry a Muslim of her choice or her parents? I'm going to really duck out of this question, because before I became a Muslim, I was married 3 times, and if I'd listened to my mother, I would never have married any of them. So, I do know that Muslim children do have, or appear to have more respect and more of a bond on these issues than non-Muslim children, and I'm sure that, there can always be good compromises worked out, but the Quran also does make it perfectly clear that if you don't want to marry somebody, then you don't have to. And I understand that during the actual marriage service, you're asked 3 times, do you really want to marry this guy? So, that forced marriages shouldn't exist in a perfect world. And the other thing that I was told is that Islam is perfect. Unfortunately, we aren't.
Question from the audience.
The banning of the hijab, I can combine that with the question about putting on the hijab if people treated you differently. The banning of the hijab in France was an absolute outrage, but let's not just focus on France. It's happening in Tunisia and Turkey, and it is disgraceful when women are being asked to choose between man-made laws and God's laws. In Turkey, what a terrible dilemma sisters are put in when they want to educate themselves, they want to go into a higher education, and they're told, well, you can come to university, but you've got to ditch the hijab. It took me a while to put on the hijab. I knew right from the beginning that it is an obligation under Islam. There's no two ways about it. It doesn't matter about fancy interpretations. As I say, if you look long and hard enough, you will find somebody who will tell you what you want to hear. The fact is, the hijab is an obligation. How you get there, when you reach that stage in your life, is entirely up to you. And I certainly do not think that sisters should be pressurized to put on the hijab until they are ready to do so. There's just an add-on to that question about what advice would I give to sisters that want to wear the hijab but are afraid because of peer pressure, family and friends. You've just got to, you'll know when you're ready to do it. You'll know when you're strong enough to do it. And, each day we are evolving and developing as Muslims, and I'm sure that we're all striving to improve ourselves each day, and when you get that strength to do it, it will happen. But there are some real plus sides to wearing the hijab. When I have been into the workplace, some of my male colleagues have come running over to see me, and then they suddenly break short and stop, and I now have this space around me, and it's really nice. And I can't remember the last time I heard a dirty joke, which is really nice. And you do get this respect, which again, is wonderful. Don't put yourself under pressure. Put it on when you're ready to put it on, and hopefully your friends will give you encouragement and strength.
Question from the back there.
How did your family take you to the university, and what would you require to do the things
that they're doing? I was very lucky. My family's reaction wasn't too hostile. I hear some terrible tales about Reva, whose family have abandoned them for years and years, which is very, very sad. But one of my sisters lives next door to a Muslim family, so she's seen the birth, the death, the marriages, and you know, just what nice, ordinary people they are. So she wasn't too alarmed. My mother's reaction was to start going to church again. She's 77, and I said, well, you know, this is wonderful. It just shows you already Islam is having a positive effect on our lives. You're getting some spirituality back. And while I really don't see myself as Islam's answer to Billy Graham, and I'm not trying to convert people to Islam, I really would like to bring my mother on board. And I said to her last year, you know, you're so close to Islam, you've just got to make that little step. Because I believe that Christianity is a great springboard to Islam. And as I say, she's 77 and she said, oh, I'm not getting involved in any newfangled Arab religion. And I said, well, where do you think Jesus was born? Manchester? And she sat and thought about it. And for the first time in her life, it suddenly registered that Christianity is, in fact, you know, has its roots in the Middle East and around Palestine. And it really opens her eyes. You know, I'd love you all to make dua for me that I will eventually get her there.
Question from there, please.
I have a question for you. We in the West are saturated with images. I'm going to focus on lots of underground tonight. And there's a load of posters, got films and, you know, videos, possibly films as well. What do you think about the balance between the ongoing desire to be beautiful, or to be thin, or to be rich, whatever it is, the balance between that and between being satisfied with who you are?
Well, that is a problem that faces Jews, Christians, Muslims, Hindus, everybody, atheists and anybody else on this out there. And we all have satisfied with our lifestyles, which is another reason why I think Islam has become the fastest growing religion in the world, because what Islam also offers, I believe anyway, is a simplicity and a very simple code of living. And it cuts away all the excesses of the West, and what you're left with is a very good and simple life. And I think that is what Western women find so exhilarating and liberating about Islam, as well as the males coming into it. It's just that your life becomes so much simpler. There's no dating in Islam, so. Once I, before I reserved it, you know, the alcohol went, and then the boyfriend went, and since I have become a revert to Islam, I haven't been stood up once, I haven't waited for the telephone to ring, I haven't been let down, and I haven't been involved in any meaningless rows and conversations. And that is liberation in itself. It's a huge chunk of confusion and aggravation that's out of my life. So it's other parts of modern living, Islam just really simplifies your life and gives you a very good code for living. That's what I find anyway. I don't know if you're a Muslim or not.
No, I'm not
a
Muslim. But I do think we'd all be a lot happier if we actually look at people when they go who they are, instead of, you know, whether they're wearing a nice in their pair of shoes or we're wearing socks or anything.
Yeah. Come and join us. It's a really good question. There were two reasons that I was wearing the hijab. One, to say it's an obligation, and, you know, somewhere along the line I knew that I would start wearing it simply because, you know, it is an obligation under Islam. But the other reason was a couple of meetings that I gave in Australia, I was asked to wear the hijab. And then when I got home, I'd taken the hijab off, and then a few days later, I got several lovely emails from some sisters who originated from Asia, and they said, we've all started wearing the hijab because you inspired us so much. We thought if you can wear the hijab, then we should as well. And I'm sitting there, you know, without the hijab on, feeling a bit of a hypocrite, really, because they saw one thing and I was doing another thing. I had a couple of false starts with the hijab. I went to Pakistan. I rang a friend of mine and said, oh, I've got to get close to my deen. Everything's falling apart. I mean, any reader will probably recognize if you take 3 steps forward and 2 steps back and you have good and bad days. And I said, I really need to get closer to my deen and I've got to try and start wearing the hijab. And they said, come and stay with the family and you know, we'll give you the support that you need. And I flew into Pakistan wearing the hijab and I was amazed at, because I visit Pakistan maybe 2 or 3 times a year, and I was amazed at the amount of women who were not wearing the hijab. And I remember spending a week with this family, you know, constantly wearing the hijab, and then I went to see a friend in an office and was sitting there having a coffee, and two of his staff came over to me and they said, what are you wearing the hijab for? You don't have to wear the hijab in this country. And I said, but it's an obligation under Islam. And they said, no, it's far too hot. And I said, well, it's a lot hotter in hell. And they looked at me and they left the office that night wearing a couple of veils. But you're right, you do come under the microscope and you do come under a different sort of pressure wearing the hijab in this country. After I left Pakistan, I've had 3-4 weeks of wearing the hijab, and I thought, right, this is it, you know, I'm a fully fledged Muslim now, I'm wearing the hijab, it's part of me now, and whether people like it or not. Bemoaning the fact that over a year ago, that she said that women who had broken through the glass ceiling and had made it to the top of their profession have done it because they followed the same route as men. And by the time they got to where they wanted to be, they were too old to have children and had sacrificed this chance to have children. Whereas if they had broken through the glass ceiling and carved their own route in their own right, by, you know, if you're in a leadership position, by creating pressures and facilities so that workplaces are child-friendly and family-friendly, then you could try and combine both. It's not, I don't believe that women can have it all. I don't believe that you can have the top job, have a family and a home life without something giving somewhere along the line. But what I did love about the Quran is that it just says, you know, just accept yourself for what you are and know you're not as strong as them and, you know, you're not like them. That's a liberating thing in itself. But having said that, I can tell you that I'm sure you've all heard about the atrocities that are happening in Fallujah. The Americans are still not in control of Fallujah. I can tell you that a number of sisters are making up the resistance in Fallujah and they are contributing. So, you know, when needs must, we can certainly rise to the occasion. That's a great compliment. And again, it just emphasizes the elevation or the status of women in Islam. I just want to leave tonight on a high. For those of you who don't know, I actually went on Hajj in January, which was a fantastic experience. And when I got back home, people were saying, what was the most moving, the most spiritual experience for you? Was it seeing the Kaaba for the first time? Was it, you know, what was it? And I have to say, it came almost unexpectedly, and you know, I was just really ambushed by this, seized by this moment. And I was running down these winding streets through Mecca because I was late for prayer. And so I turned around the corner towards the mosque. There were tens of thousands of pilgrims, people of every race, every nationality, every colour, every tongue, you know, just, it was just a real compendium, a real cocktail of Muslims, and it was just totally just a sea of chaos. And then the Azan was called, and within seconds, everybody snapped into line. One after another just snapped in straight lines on the street. And I looked around and I thought, there isn't an army in the world that could stand to attention so quickly like that. There isn't a single army in the world. And it's just, you know, you talk about emotions before, and I just started to cry and I just thought, we are so strong when we are united. And we can, you know, we're an unbeatable force if we're like this all the time. You know, why are we like this just 5 times a day? Why can't we be like this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? If we were as strong and as disciplined as that, 24/7, nobody would dare humiliate us. Nobody would dare invade our lands. Nobody would dare kidnap our brothers and sisters and throw them in prison and abuse them. Nobody was there. People would stop and treat us with respect. And I just thought, you know, we have the potential to achieve great things if we concentrate on what unites us and what keeps us together. And as I say, you know, there aren't any moderate Muslims. There aren't any extremists. There aren't any of different types of Muslims. We are all Muslims together. And, you know, we all believe in the 5 pillars of Islam, and that is what bonds us together. And that was probably the most emotional, spiritual, and poignant moment for me out of the whole Hajj experience. And I just thought I'd share it with you. Thank you.